well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. I am so glad to be with you once again today. Larry Keene from the National Shooting Sports Foundation going to be with us here in a moment or two. Going to be talking primarily about what is going on in Colorado. We've seen no shortage of really bad bills introduced around the country this year when it comes to our right to keep and bear arms, but so far, I think Colorado takes the cake with SB3, a sweeping gun ban bill that would prohibit the sale and manufacture of virtually, I won't say every semi-automatic firearm, but the vast majority of semi-automatic firearms in the country and in the state of Colorado. So, and by the way, this isn't some like outlier bill, right? I mean, we see this every year where a lot of bills get introduced. Most of them, most bills, not just most gun control bills, but just most bills don't get very far, right? This one, though, SB3 in Colorado seems to be a top priority, not just to the gun control lobby, but for Democrats in Colorado as well. And that is why we need to focus on it, even in the early days of the legislative session. So let's get right to our conversation with Larry Keene from the National Shooting Sports Foundation. Take a look and a listen. Larry, thanks so much for coming on the show today. It is good to see you, sir.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Cam. And let me just point out, pitchers and catchers report in less than a month.
Okay. All right. I guess what the Yankees or the Red Sox, we both lost out on the Juan Soto sweepstakes, yes. Right? So it's going to be an interesting year in the AL East. We will, I'm keeping my fingers crossed that we'll see some improvement for the Red Sox, but yeah, not long to go. And also, you know, pitchers and catchers report here in a few weeks. You're reporting to Las Vegas here sooner than that because we've got SHOT Show coming up in, next week?
Next week. I actually fly out on Saturday. We've got, industry meetings Sunday, Monday, and then we cut the ribbon Tuesday morning, and then it goes all the way to Friday afternoon. So it's Saturday to Saturday for me in Vegas. So
rest up.
It's insanely busy. The funny thing is, I spend very little time on the floor itself. And if I'm on the floor, it's because I'm going to this meeting or to talk to this person. I'm not out on the floor just, checking stuff out. There's just no time for me anyway. But it's going to be the biggest show ever in terms of net square footage.
Mm-hmm.
The number of exhibitors, we're setting records. And we don't try to set records on attendance. Actually, we try to, we've been on a kick to reduce attendance because we want quality of attendees over quantity. So that's not a metric that we actually focus on the quality of the attendee over the number, but square footage wise and exhibitors, it's record setting.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a couple of years since I've been able to make it to SHOT, but the last time I was there, you all had already expanded over into the Caesars Forum, and I mean, it was just massive. I think over the course of a week, I think maybe I saw half of the booths, and I was talking to John Petrolino, one of our Bearing Arms contributors. He will be at SHOT next week, and he said, I'm going to try to get you some stuff, some stories. I said, don't even worry about it because there's so much to see. I said, just go soak it up and then come back and write about what you saw. Right. Don't try to do it all because you'll burn yourself out. But it is truly incredible. The growth that we have seen. I wish that I could be there this year, but I will be there in 2026. And in the meantime, got a lot of stuff to talk about, Larry, because, there are politicians out there. There are groups out there who want to shut down SHOT Show. They want to negate our right to keep and bear arms. They want to make it impossible for us to purchase or possess some of the most commonly owned firearms in the country. And we're seeing this in a very big way out in Colorado, right, with the introduction of a semi-auto ban. And this is basically a ban on all semi-automatic firearms or semi-automatic long guns with detachable magazines, which is the vast majority of semi-automatic long guns out there.
I don't know how they keep doing it. They sort of get more and more absurd. So this is the worst gun ban bill I have ever seen in my career, which, now 30 years. It's kind of based on the federal bill that was introduced in the last Congress by Senator Martin Heinrich and Senator Angus King from Maine, the Go Safe Act. So basically, this is a massive, the most massive gun ban, gun grab I've ever seen. It would effectively ban all semi-automatic rifles with detachable magazines. So this is not banning MSRs or so-called assault weapons, right? If it's got a magazine and it's semi-automatic, it's probably banned. The same for handguns or even shotguns with detachable magazines that are semi-automatic. So it's massive. This is the Governor Polis gun ban. It is going to move very, very quickly, we are told, in the legislature. This is going to surprise your audience, I'm sure, to find out that this is every town's number one priority. They're the ones who drafted this bill. They've been lying to members of the legislature saying it's not a gun ban. And then the text comes out, and guess what? It's a gun ban, right? It's a gun grab, massive. So it's like, you don't need to bother banning detachable magazines over a certain size. Just ban guns that take detachable magazines. And then even the fixed magazines can't have a restriction on capacity. So, it's really bad. It's going, we have been told it's going to move very, very quickly through the legislature. So we need, everybody in Colorado, but not just Colorado, to weigh in, have their voices heard. Especially if you live in Colorado, pick up the phone, call your state senator, call your state representative, call the governor's office. I mean, I would really like to see our community melt the switchboard, the governor's office, and at the Capitol in Denver, to make sure they understand this bill's unacceptable. It's actually dangerous, right? For training purposes. It's much harder to know how many rounds are in a fixed magazine. It's much easier to train somebody on a semi-automatic where you can remove the magazine and have one round in the chamber to train on. Obviously people prefer firearms with detachable magazines. That is the, obviously commonly owned. They're ubiquitous, right? I mean, so, people need to weigh in and help stop the Governor Polis gun ban.
Absolutely. We're waiting to see what the Supreme Court does with Snope versus Brown, right? The lawsuit taken on Maryland's semi-auto ban. And that is not a straight semi-auto ban. That is more of a, modern sporting rifle ban. But again, I mean, there's no set definition of what an assault weapon is, right? If Colorado wants to define an assault weapon as any semi-automatic firearm that it can accept a detachable magazine, they can do that because it's a made-up phrase, right?
It's entirely made up. It's a political term, right? It has no meaning in the industry, people that design firearms. It's Josh Sugarman created the term from the Violence Policy Center in order to ban semi-automatic rifles. And semi-automatic firearms. So yeah, and look, you see it when people like Dettelbach goes up to his confirmation hearing. You want to ban, or Dave Chipman before, you want to ban assault weapons, define it. They can't, yeah. Right? Because it's a made-up term.
Yeah, absolutely. And I certainly hope that the Supreme Court, steps in and takes the Snope case, because if they don't, we're watching this play out in real time. The Supreme Court says, for whatever reason, we're not going to take this case, the gun control advocates are going to see that as a green light to move forward with bills just like the one that they've introduced in Colorado. And it's not going to stay there in Colorado. As you say, this was drafted by every town. So this is going to be exported to every state in the country where they think that they can get this enacted into law.
And I think the reason they are pushing this as fast as they can is because they want to get it on the books before the Supreme Court might decide if they take the Snopes or the Ocean State Tactical case out of the First Circuit, which is a magazine ban from Rhode Island. Those are two cases that are still, pending before the court. They were conferenced on Friday, nothing announced yesterday. So we'll see what happens with those cases. But I do think, the Supreme Court has got to take a so-called hardware case once and for all. And so, you know, the Fourth Circuit case, Snopes, is well positioned. It's after a trial. The Ocean State case out of the First Circuit, one of the worst decisions we've ever seen. It's just, you know, intellectually dishonest. Is it a preliminary injunction stage? Court tends to not take cases at that point. That was the case, like for the Seventh Circuit case that NSSF filed, challenging the Illinois law. But yeah, they, you know, every town, a lot of money, and wants to, you know, they like to say common sense, you know, gun safety legislation. Well, it's common nonsense is what it is. So, you know, look, if you cherish your rights, if you want to be able to own and purchase semi-automatic rifles and handguns with detachable magazines, and you live in Colorado, you've got to pick up the phone and call your legislator, call your senators, call your representatives, call the governor's office. When they're home, and they're not in Denver, go to their office, knock on the door, right? Like, find them at town halls and things like that. Find them when they're in the grocery store, you know, and, you know, the most effective means of influencing legislation is a, you know, face-to-face, person-to-person conversation. Next is handwritten notes and phone calls. So do all, right? Like, call, write a letter, show up, have a face-to-face conversation, and make sure that the Governor Polis gun ban is defeated.
Absolutely. This is Senate Bill 3, by the way, yeah. You know, just for the specific bill number, because I know sometimes lawmakers will give you an excuse not to pay attention to what you have to say. So, you know, make sure that you're telling them it's this bill. This is the one we're talking about here, so they can't play stupid. Larry, yeah. Again, let I really appreciate.
Let me give you the number as well, your audience, the number for the governor's switchboard.
And yeah. That's
303-866-2471. 303-866-2471. Let's melt the switchboard, as they say in politics.
Yeah. And it is not too early. You know, sometimes we'll say, you know, hold off. Let's see what happens to the bill. But at this point, it's pretty clear that this is a top priority of House and Senate Democrats. They've been trying to get a gun ban bill across the finish line and to the governor's desk for the past couple of years. This year, I think it is more likely than ever that they're going to be able to do this and get it to Polis's desk. So now is the time to start contacting the governor. And reminding him, he took an oath, frankly, you know, to respect the Constitution and banning some of the most commonly owned firearms and commonly produced firearms in this country would violate that oath.
And if he signs this bill, you know, he owns it, right? He owns it going forward. Some people think he has presidential aspirations. And if he signs it and it becomes law, I can assure you there will be lots of legal challenges, including NSSF will challenge this law immediately in court as a violation of the Second Amendment.
Yeah.
Egregious. This is worse in Illinois.
Absolutely. So let's try to defeat it before, you know, in the state house. So we don't have to try to defeat it in the courthouse. Larry, right. Again, I really appreciate you coming on the program. We will definitely be staying up to date with you. I won't bug you next week when you're in Vegas, but when you get back, after you've had time to catch up on your sleep, would love to have you back maybe week after next. And I do have to ask you before we let you go, because I haven't spoken to you since I think it was the New York Times report came out that mentioned you as a contender for the ATF director.
And that article mentioned a lot of people. I've heard names flying all over the place. I have no idea what President Trump intends to do. I think the focus is on getting his cabinet picks confirmed, including Pam Bondi from Florida, and then the deputy attorney general. I think that'll be done before they give, you know, they really focus on the ATF position. In the meantime, unsurprisingly, Director Dalebach is retiring, leaving on the 18th. This was, I've known that since, you know, probably mid-November or thereabouts. So there was some, you know, news reporting on it, but it's been a known thing and it's normal, right? So in the meantime, when that happens, the deputy director, who's Marvin Richardson, takes over, at least initially, and then we'll see what happens. You know, NSSF has been involved in, you know, communicating with the transition team, the qualifications and background we think would make an ideal candidate. So we'll see what the administration does. Hopefully they will, and I'm confident they will get ATF refocused on its core mission of protecting public safety, going after trigger pullers, as they like to say. Stop attacking the industry, stop calling the industry, as Biden did, the enemy, and restore trust and confidence in the relationship, the cooperative relationship between the industry and ATF, which, you know, ATF special agents and past directors have said is essential for ATF to perform its public safety mission. They need assistance and cooperation from the industry, not just follow the regulations, but in providing information. The number one source of information to ATF that leads to trafficking investigations comes from dealers who have no legal obligation, but nevertheless pick up the phone and call ATF and say, hey, somebody was in here, here's what happened, and that leads to trafficking investigations. So, and we certainly want to see more enforcement of the existing laws. You know, we're aware of the fact that even though now there's a standalone crime of stored purchasing, a standalone crime of illegal firearms trafficking, in places like Arizona, we don't see prosecutions by the U.S. Attorney's Office. And the U.S. Attorney out there is somebody who was directly involved in Fast and Furious, actually. Yeah. So we need to see changes at the U.S. Attorney's, and we need to see more vigorous enforcement. Many, many cases are referred to ATF or by ATF to U.S. Attorney's offices, and in parts of the country, they're not prosecuted. So, that's a problem. That's not acceptable.
Absolutely. All right, Larry. Listen, again, I appreciate you joining us on the program. Safe travels to Vegas and back, and have a great SHOT Show. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, buddy. Always good to spend time with you.
Always good to spend time with you as well. Larry Keene joining us from the National Shooting Sports Foundation here on Bearing Arms Cam and Company. My thanks to Larry for joining us on the program, and looking forward to having him back again here in a couple of weeks. Right now, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We will start there with a story from Fox 5 in New York City. Here's the headline. New York City man accused of randomly stabbing 14-year-old has long rap sheet. Who is he? Maybe the better question is, why did he have such a long rap sheet? Waldo Mejia is the individual's name. He was arrested last Friday, charged in connection with the fatal stabbing of a 14-year-old in the Bronx. And according to Fox 5 in New York, he does have an extensive criminal record at age 29. Mejia also has a documented history of mental illness. He's now been charged with second-degree murder, first-degree manslaughter, and criminal possession of a weapon in the fourth degree. His criminal record goes back almost a decade, back to 2015. He's been arrested 4 times for burglary, arson, possession of a gun. And last year, he was arrested for stabbing another victim's Ring camera with a kitchen knife, released on his own recognizance the very next day. According to the New York Post, Mejia was booted from a hearing on Sunday after a rant about the White House, Al-Qaeda, and Satan. A court officer told the New York Post he started yelling, "White House and Al-Qaeda," adding, "He's back there yapping now. He's just nuts. You can look at his face and you can see it." So, again, why was Mejia out on the street? Why was he able to allegedly carry out this stabbing at a subway station, by the way, a gun-free zone, a weapons-free zone, in New York City? This is bizarre. I'm sorry. You know what? I take it back. The stabbing of the 14-year-old Caleb Rios actually happened not at a subway station. There was another stabbing that took place at a subway station in New York on earlier in the week, on Sunday of this week. A 38-year-old man, Fox 5 reported, randomly stabbed from behind at a subway station. 3rd Avenue, 138th Street, again, in that weapon-free zone. Not sure if the location, the Mitchell Houses in the Mott Haven neighborhood of New York, I'm not sure if that is a weapons-free zone as well, but What we do know is that the criminal justice system in New York allowed this individual, again, with a documented history of mental illness and a 10-year long rap sheet, to be out on the street and in a position to, again, allegedly attack and kill a 14-year-old boy. So maybe, just maybe, it's time for New York lawmakers, both in New York City and in Albany, to quit trying to turn responsible gun owners into paperwork criminals for exercising their Second Amendment rights and start going after those folks with an extensive history of violent crime, those who are not just mentally ill, but those who are dangerously mentally ill, instead, again, of treating lawful, responsible gun owners as if they are the problem that needs to be solved. All right, turning now to our armed citizen story from St. Louis, Missouri, where a murder case has been dropped after the, I was going to say the alleged perpetrator. They did dismiss charges, so I guess prosecutors did believe that she was a perpetrator of a crime at some point. She did claim self-defense, and prosecutors sound like they are unable to refute those claims. Marissa Lewis was facing charges of first-degree murder as well as armed criminal action after the death of 26-year-old Brittany Ritchie outside of a home. This happened last year. Lewis's attorney, Terry Niehoff, said the case was clearly self-defense. He said that Ritchie showed up at Lewis's home early in the morning of March 3rd, 2024, quote, looking for a fight. Lewis brought a firearm outside when she confronted Ritchie and told her to leave. Instead, Lewis's attorney says that Ritchie reached for the gun. The pair struggled, and Lewis ended up shooting Ritchie in the leg. Lewis's attorney also said that Ritchie had gone to Lewis's home before. His client had called the police previously. Ritchie had been charged with disturbing the peace. And again, in this particular case, Marissa Lewis, originally facing charges of first-degree murder, now not facing charges at all after prosecutors dismissing those charges in the face of her self-defense claim. Finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, when unable to do the right thing, a Kansas City man who was recently honored and rewarded for helping to recover some stolen cars back in 2023. Now, when I saw this headline, I thought, well, why did it take so long for them to recognize this, what this guy did? Larry Little, I think it was May of 2023, saw a story on Fox 4 in Kansas City about two classic cars that had been stolen. These cars were set to be auctioned off to benefit the City Union Mission and the Salvation Army. And when Larry Little saw this news report in May of 2023, he thought, you know, I want to find those cars. One was a 1970 Chevelle SS. There was a 1967 Camaro. So again, worth a pretty good amount of money. And the successful auction of those vehicles would have raised a lot of money for the Union Mission. So the day after Larry Little saw that news report, he said he decided to stop by his dad's house. He was a couple blocks away. He saw a trailer with a tarp over a car. It pulled in front of him. And the trailer was actually had the 1970 Chevelle SS there on the bed. So he followed the trailer. He called 911. He said they finally pulled over. Cops arrived, jumped out of the car, asked me what I was doing. I said, I'm on the phone talking to the cops right now. They hopped out of the car and did the trailer from the truck and took off. Wow. So they were able to recover not just the Chevelle. Eventually, they were able to recover the 1967 Camaro as well. And as for why it took so long for the City Union Mission to honor Larry Little for keeping a keen eye out for those stolen vehicles, this is where it gets really good. There was a volunteer with the City Union Mission named Jim Ross. And when Mr. Ross heard about what Little had done, he said, I kind of nudged my wife and she looked at me and smiled. He said, we were definitely thinking the same thing. We had this old motorcycle that was in pieces in our garage. He said, my son and I were planning to fix it up, and I felt like God was saying, hey, you've been granted many blessings, so let's use this to bless somebody else. See, Larry Little said he was motivated to track down these stolen cars because 30 years ago, thieves stole a motorcycle that he and his dad were restoring. So after Jim Ross heard that, looked at his wife, and we got this old motorcycle. So they decided to restore their motorcycle. Took a little bit of time. But on Monday of this week, they presented that bike to Larry Little. Ross said it was kind of a tearjerker, very special. He said, I'd love seeing him get something back. You know, something that he had stolen as a kid. That is fantastic. City Union Mission CEO Terry Megley said, it's incredible to be able to see the beginning of a tragic incident where criminals took advantage of someone's generosity, and then seeing how the community through Fox 4 and the listeners of Fox 4 said, we want to do something about this. And then to be able to see the next stage where you have a volunteer that says, hey, I want to give back to that hero. He said, it's an incredible feeling to see that something that started out as tragic now has something good, hopeful, and positive coming out of it. Absolutely. And again, in the right place, at the right time, willing able to do the right thing. Not because he thought he would get something out of it, other than that warm, fuzzy feeling of doing the right thing. Larry Little in Kansas City, Missouri, we thank you for your very, very good deed, and enjoy your new ride. All right, that's going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. Looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. But don't forget to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day. We're covering the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. John Petrolino has two very lengthy pieces on the upcoming NRA elections. The reformers, the old guard, or NRA strong. There are definitely two camps when it comes to the NRA elections. And John has a very detailed couple of pieces looking at both camps in the NRA's elections. And we've got more legislation, litigation, regulation news to cover as well. So be sure to check it all out again at BearingArms.com. We'll see you back here tomorrow for another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. In the meantime, be well, be safe, be free. And I'm going to say it just like I did yesterday, in honor of Missy. Make stuff. We'll see you back here tomorrow.